the really big picture is it's actually quite simple to lay out. You know, I think it's pretty obvious that I'm not a scientist, but the world is heating up, you know. There's general consensus that the world is heating up. And one of the things that is never mentioned, which really gives you a good perspective on one of the main reasons we're heating up, is the actual amount of carbon that's being sequestered in the forest today versus what it was, you know, thousands of years ago. One reference point from which you can get a really good perspective on it is to think that it's generally agreed on that at the end of the last ice age, whatever it was, 8 or 10,000 years ago, that 50 to 55% of the landmass outside of the polar regions was covered in forest. Most of that being forests of trees of all ages, but with a lot of volume, a lot of big trees. So compare that to where we're at right now. Right now, depending on what you consider forest land, we're 22 to 24% of the earth outside of the polar regions is forested. You know, that's not so bad. We went from 55% to 22%. We've lost, you know, 60%, right? Well, maybe, but not really. Because if you look at the remaining 22 to 24%, what you find is that the great majority of it is young forests. And so when you consider that, you realize that it's not that you've lost 60%, you've lost 80 to 90% of your of the carbon that was once sequestered in the forest. And because even though we're down to 22 or 24%, that remaining land has maybe a third of the volume or a fourth of the volume that it could have in terms of sequestered carbon. Mm-hmm. There's only a certain percentage of those that are preserves or that are in the virgin forest anymore. Most of it are young forest trees that are coming back from farmlands that have gone feral and are returning to forests, mostly in the United States and in industrialized countries. So That's the big picture. The big picture is 80% plus of the carbon that was once in the forest is no longer there. So what we're trying to do is, at whatever scale we can, is increase the amount of carbon that's being sequestered per acre to as much, to the high level as you can, while the forest itself paves its way. And that's a big deal, because all the forests of the world can't be turned into parks. It's just economically impossible. So what percentage of forests are in parks? A small percentage, I don't know, 10, 15%, 20%. But nobody can put most of the forests are actually in production. Most of the forests are being managed for lumber and other things. And it's that percentage, the bulk of the forest, that needs to be managed at a higher level. And that's what we're trying to do. By cutting at the rate that we cut, the forest sequesters enormous amounts of carbon long-term and in perpetuity, while the sustainable forestry movement that's now so popular worldwide sequesters 2.5 to 3 times less carbon than the restoration forestry practices that Hans Burkhardt actually was the one who perfected. And Hans's study lays it out. But that's the big picture. The big picture is we need to get that 22 or 24% to have significantly more volume as quickly as possible. And, you know, we're just a little guppy in the redwood forest, but nonetheless, I think that what we're doing is going to allow us to grow, and we want to keep growing and create an institution that will continue to grow and fund itself into the next century so that eventually it can be an example that will dominate the industry. It's the only way to do it. You can't do it through jawboning. You can't do it through government action, because, you know, every new government administration changes forestry practices. Just look at what the U.S. Forest Service has done over the past 100 years, where they started very conservatively under Gifford Pinchon 100 years ago, and then right after World War II, under economic pressures from, you know, World War II veterans coming back, they started increasing the rate of cut dramatically, and they started actually doing some crazy stuff in the U.S. Forest Service until the 80s when there was a big battle, and then in the 90s, and now it's gone the other way, and now they're being super conservative, and they're hardly cutting anything, and lots of people have lost their jobs. So there's no continuity over time. It's just based on politics. So that's not going to work either. So what we need is an economic model that demonstrates the highest level of ecology while being financially stable. And I think the only way you could do it is by creating a value-added product line for the most part, or even sell lumber at incredible premiums because it's going to be very high quality. Where forever redwood is going to annihilate the competition is in that we've already gone through the really hard part, which is to get through the first decade of extensive restoration work. It's very costly to where, and develop the product line and develop the label, you know, the name for, you know, we have a lot of followers now, so we're able to sell our products at a good price because people know what they're going to get, and that allows us to pay for it. And we lost money for 11 years. Last year we made a small profit. This year we're going to make a better profit. Still minor, but we've turned the corner, and I don't think we're going to look back. So anyway, that's the big picture. You know, there's timberland companies all over the redwoods and all over the world that are run on quarterly profits or run on, you know, pension fund reports. And those types of companies, those types of entities have a fundamental disadvantage long term. They can't actually manage their forest lands to keep the money, the main capital of their business, to keep it in the woods. They have to cut the trees as fast as they can or close to as fast as they can in order to maintain their quarterly profits or maintain the officers and political goodwill. They'll get kicked out. If I was running a Fortune 500 forestry company, or I don't even think such a thing exists anymore, but a big forestry company, I couldn't sell to my shareholders the idea that we should limit our rate of cut and keep the money in the woods. They would just vote me right out of office. So what do you have? All these big forestry companies, they practice liquidation forestry. Whatever their green marketing message, the truth is their forests are cut as fast as they can cut them. And they're always trying to figure out ways of growing trees faster and blah, 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 basically degrading the environment. And so now everyone's covering their butt with the sustainable forestry stuff. But, you know, the Consumer Union's report that you saw and that you published in the blog, that basically lays it there, just letting you know that both the FSC and the industry-sponsored sustainable forestry certifications are bosh, you know, they're BS. So there aren't any examples out there, and that's what we're trying to do, is create this example. We are doing it. So there.
So there are no other companies you know of that are trying something similar?
No, there's some good sustainable forestry companies, relatively benign sustainable forestry companies, even in the redwoods, like the Big Creek Lumber Company. They've got like 10 or 15,000 acres down to Santa Cruz, and Barry's Sawmills. They manage their lands pretty sustainably. Even the Mendocino Redwoods Company recently got certified, you know, being sustainable. They got a huge amount of acreage. But if you really look at their rate of cuts and you really look at their practices, there's a huge difference between that and what we're doing. If you look at Hans Burkhardt's chart, the ecoforestry chart, the difference between a 1% per year rate of cut and a 2% per year rate of cut in the long term, it's 2.5 times the amount of standing timber over a course of 100 years. You get 2.5 times more standing timber from a piece of land that you manage at a 1% rate of cut versus a 2% rate of cut. And 2% is the very, very best that the best of the sustainable forestry companies are doing. Most of them are getting 2.5 to 3%. When you get to that level, then the amount of lumber that they can actually sequester drops significantly, where they can only do maybe a quarter of what our forestry practices will accomplish over the course of 100 years. But you see, that's the ecological side. The economical side is, as the decades go by, when you manage your land very conservatively the way we do, you have a lot of volume and you have slow-growing trees because they have a lot more competition between them. That results in incredible quality lumber. So as time goes by, lands managed under a restoration forestry practice like ours produce lumber of a quality that is much higher than that being harvested under sustainable or less than sustainable practices because of the rate of growth, mostly because of the rate of growth. There's also other things like the limbing that eliminates knots and that kind of stuff. So that's where our vision for the long run annihilates the competition. Because 50 years from now, we will have a forest of redwood trees that are huge, and they'll produce incredible lumber. Nobody else will have that. Some of the good sustainable forestry companies will have decent-sized redwood trees. They can make decent, you know, good quality lumber. And no one will have exquisite quality lumber except for Forever Redwood or anyone else that manages their lands or have been managing their lands the way we have. Because old growth will not exist in any kind of commercial quantity. It already doesn't exist. Imagine 50 years from now or 25 years from now.
So, this book or this essay or whatever it's going to be, do you want to, are you trying to kind of evangelize, restoration forestry so that other companies, other individuals take it up and do it themselves? Is that part of what you want to do?
We used to think that, but that's not going to happen because it takes a long time to train people to do it right. But basically, what we want to do is offer other people the opportunity to have their lands managed the way we manage ours. And basically, we would certify them, Old Growth Again would certify them as being in a restoration forestry regimen. And we would pay them a premium for their lumber if they let us manage their lands. So every 10 or 15 years, we'd come in, we'd harvest a limited amount of lumber, we'd do the thinning, we do the planting, we do the soil building practices, we do the soil erosion work that we need to do, whatever it is we need to do. And they would get paid a premium. We're doing this already, by the way, on 120 acres. They would get paid a premium above market rates. Whatever the market rate is, we would give them 20% more. And then we would subtract whatever our timber, our management costs would be. But even after with taking our management costs and managing the lands really carefully, they would net significantly more than if they managed their lands for regular harvesting. Plus, their forest would look much, much better when we're done. And each time we go in, it's going to get better and better. Not only in appearance, but in wildlife habitat and productivity and the quality of the stand, et cetera. So we think that restoration, that ability for you to participate and be certified as a restoration forestry operation will give us the tool to grow much faster than if we're actually just buying all the land. We want to buy whatever land we can, but I think we're going to grow faster, or at least as fast doing this as buying.
Is that mostly on the West Coast, California?
For right now, we want to stay in the Redwoods, and then I think we should go north first into Oregon and Washington State and manage the cedar and Douglas fir forest up there. I think that's a natural progression beyond the Redwoods. But who knows, maybe in my lifetime we'll never even make it out of the Redwoods. It would be great to do restoration forestry in every country of the world. And, you know, in my wildest dreams, I think that if our product line continues to develop and our name continues to improve, that, you know, we could be making serious money and start growing operations elsewhere. But I don't want to stretch myself too thin. So at least for the foreseeable future, the next decade or so, I think just going north and concentrating in the redwoods and the cedar forests of the Pacific Northwest is a viable plan, you know. I'm gonna set up manufacturing in North Africa at some point, 2, 4, 6 years from now, and preferably very close to Gibraltar, you know, like in Morocco or something, so we can easily get our products into the European market and into the Middle East, because that's a market that's as big or bigger than the U.S. and Canada, and we can't access it from Mexico. It just doesn't work. Shipping is just exorbitant.
So would the lumber still come from California, or would you have other sources of it?
Well, initially it would come from the Pacific Northwest, from California or Oregon, if we're already in Oregon. We would we would ship it in containers on a ship, you know, just load up containers full of lumber and ship it. But long term, I'd like to, you know, be involved in restoration work in the cedars of Lebanon and, you know, most of the world was forested at one point. Most of North Africa and along the coast had forests, which people don't even understand. Israel was 85% forest at one point. Now it's 15% forest, and that's after the Hebrew state has done a lot of work to improve the amount of forest, right? There's a lot that can be done. Just have to create an economic engine to fund it all. And that's what's taken the last 10 years of my life to do.
Is furniture the main product that can be produced from the lumber that comes out of restoration forestry?
No, you can do anything with it. You can make houses. You can make boats. You can make anything you want. You know, it's just. We just focused on outdoor furniture because redwood is known for outdoors, but it just doesn't make sense to sell lumber. You know, it's crazy to be a standard forestry company. That's why I know that they're all right for the picket. Because how can you sell logs? Like, for example, redwood logs right now, depending on the quality, they're selling between 60 cents and 90 cents, maybe a dollar a board foot for the very high quality ones. A dollar a board foot for the very best. On average, about 70, 75 cents a board foot today. Logs. Now, if you mill the logs yourself and you sell the wood, then depending on the grade, you're going to get anywhere from, you know, 40 cents a board foot for the junk up to, you know, $6, $7 a board foot for the very best stuff. But on average, you're going to probably get somewhere around $2, $2.50 a board foot. If you're lucky, you'll get that much. But you got milling costs and all that stuff too. So that's about as good as you can do as a typical lumber company like Pacific Lumber was, right? Now, Forever Redwood, they're vertically integrated. We're not going to sell logs. We're not going to sell lumber. We're going to take the lumber and make it a high quality product line that we're going to sell on average between $10 and $20 a board foot. $10 and $20 a board foot. So we're up, you know, factor of 5 to 8 times what a typical lumber company can sell a board because they're selling it as a board. We're selling it as a high-quality finished product. I don't care if it's furniture. I don't care if it's maracas. It doesn't matter to me. It just has to be sold at a very high premium. And the only way to do that is to make a very high-quality product. You know, maybe we'll start making shelving. Maybe we'll make high-end flooring. But even that, even flooring and shelving, the return isn't that great. The best return is to making high-end tables and swings and that kind of stuff. So we'll continue to develop high-end product lines. Unfortunately, you know, you can't market your stuff to everybody. You have to market to those who have a green ethic and who have the money to appreciate and pay for really high-quality wood products.
Hmm. Tell me about the design and how, you know, who are your designers? How do you come up with new designs? I mean, I know some of this already, but I want to kind of get, you know, get it out of you or get it recorded, because so much of the value of the product comes from not just the quality of the wood, but the quality of the design that goes into the product, right?
Well, you know, when, for example, when Julius first took a look at our line and said, oh, God, this isn't ergonomic, this wasn't designed by professionals, blah, blah, blah. And I just listened to him, you know. But the real secret for us is, well, here's how it all happened, you know. Back in the late 90s when we had this great old-growth redwood that we were pulling out of the forest, thinking, okay, what are we going to do with it? We decided we were going to make some picnic tables for some of our patrons, some of our early on patrons. And I decided right off the bat, look, whatever we're going to make it real thick timber, high-quality timber, the very best fasteners, the very best sealant, everything the best we can find. And so we looked up some designs, and then we beefed them up. And you know, the first stuff we made wasn't that good. But we just kept at it. But the big secret wasn't that. I mean, that was one thing, the motif about high quality, thick timber, stick to that, don't cut corners. But we always were willing to custom size or custom design or custom build anything our customers wanted, just about anything. And so a lot of the ideas for our product line came from the fact that we were always had a lot of real estate on our website copy saying, you know, see what you like, let us know. If you could send us a picture or if you can describe it, we can build it, right? And so our customers became a significant source of design ideas. Not necessarily finished designs, but design ideas, which then Tony, our main carpenter, and myself would fine-tune and give it our own little flavor. And basically, that's been the major forces developing the product line. I also was dating a nationally known architect who had a great eye, and when I was first designing some pieces, she pointed out some things, how to avoid, you know, contradictions in your lines and, you know, just some basic stuff, which I seem to have a certain aptitude for, so I caught on. And and Tony does have a good eye. So between him and I, and our customers, our product line continues to organically develop. And, you know, we've got maybe 300 different products on the website or more, and we've probably developed hundreds of other products, some of them which will make it onto the site eventually, and others that just don't seem to, we don't think they have a mass appeal, so we don't put them up there. But, you know, we're just getting started. I mean, there's so many things you could do with wood that we haven't even touched, like an interior product line. We barely have an interior product line. We might even decide to just get into making front doors. You know, there's a whole business of making good, thick quality wooden doors that I think we can really, you know, grab a piece of that market to fund more forest restoration. So with wood, and let's get higher quality and higher quality wood over time. The world's pretty wide open, because wood products is in everybody's, you know, subconscious, kind of like, you know, we all grew up with wood. Our ancestors grew up with wood. Wood has always been part of human culture, you know. The fact that now we're kind of running out of wood and everything is this wood substitute stuff and, you know, this tracks, all this plastic crap. I mean, people buy it, but if they have the opportunity to buy good quality wood instead, those who have the money will, not always, but a lot of them will go for the wood. We get regular calls from brick and mortar stores and from other virtual stores, you know, websites to carry our product. And we usually make it pretty easy for people to do that. You know, we give them a substantial wholesale price and set them free. Unfortunately, over the years, we probably have gone through 100 such relationships, and we've only got 7 or 10 right now that are producing any kind of volume, you know. We probably have live, living relationships with different companies that carry our products, probably 30 or 35 right now. But you add them all together, and they barely maybe make 10% of our total sales. Our website is a powerful sales tool because we're constantly working on it. And people have the option to buy directly from the manufacturer. They usually choose it, even if they have to pay a little bit more. People tell me, it's like, hey, I saw your stuff on such and such website. Is that your stuff? And we tell them, yeah. They say, well, why are they selling it for less? They say, well, maybe they get it at a wholesale price, and they think that, you know, maybe that's how they want to market it, but it's the same product. And they always say the same thing. They always say, well, can you meet the price or get close to it? We'd rather go with the manufacturer. So the online stuff, our resellers, we've tried affiliate marketing, doesn't work for us. What I think would work is if we had some kind of program to reach out to brick-and-mortar stores, people that have furniture shops, patio furniture shops, and try to sell to them. The problem is most of those stores usually want to work with a company or manufacturer that doesn't have his own website. They don't want to compete with the manufacturer. So then they want you to go to a different model where you're dependent on all these stores to sell your product. And that always seemed too scary to us, so we never did it. And we were told by people in the industry that they had to choose one or the other. A lot of cheap manufacturers go that route where they sell only through stores, and you can't buy directly from them. If you go to their website, it just refers you to their dealer network. Okay. You've got the forest restoration manual, which really gives you the beef of the actual work in the woods. So we need to cover that again. I mean, that's been hashed out pretty thoroughly. You've got some of the videos that give you some more perspective. But, you know, I always thought that the work that Hans Burkhardt did, and my opening points about the deterioration of the forest cover and the size of the forest over the millennia, that's the big issue. And nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about that. So people get, they get emotional about saving the trees and about the Amazon being cut down, yada, yada, the habitat being lost for the spotted lemur or whatever it is, That's all great, but those are details. Those are details. Those are consequences of the big picture of nobody watching the big picture. So the big picture is we need to increase the size of the trees on the working forest of the earth. That's the big picture. If you can double the amount of standing timber on the acreage that are working forests worldwide, you will accomplish almost a doubling of the amount of carbon being sequestered by forest lands. And that's huge. Now, you think that's going to take 100 years? No, it's not going to take 100 years. Our forest lands, for example, in 1994, had on average 8,000 board feet to the acre when we first got started. 8,000. 17 years later, we've doubled it. And we've harvested lumber. We're at 16,000 board feet per acre on average on all our lands today, 17 years later, while running a business. So in 20 years, you can take young forest land and double its standing timber volume. Now, we're not anywhere near what it was when it was harvested, which is probably about 50,000 board feet to the acre on average. But we're substantially there. And in another 30 or 40 years, we'll be to a point where you won't be able to really tell the difference. Unless you're an expert, you won't really be able to tell the difference between our managed forests and an old growth park. You really won't. Because of the way it's managed. There's a professor at Humboldt State University named Steve Stillett who with the emphasis of the National Geographic's video that was done last year on climbing the redwood giants, and he wrote a book called it was a book written about him called The Wild Trees, he's the professor that spends a lot of time up in the big trees studying the animals and the fauna and the flora that exists only up in the canopy of these big trees in the crotches. And I went to hear him speak at Humboldt State University in September and October of 2010. Yeah. 2009. And one of the things he said was that one of the justifications for cutting old growth all through time was that the old growth trees were decadent and they were decaying at the rate that was equal to or greater than the rate that they were adding lumber. Therefore, it was best to cut them down so that new trees could start growing, right? That's the gospel. That's the gospel to this day on old growth. Well, he's been doing studies in the redwood forest in the old growth, and he's proven that that's a bunch of bullshit. Just not true. That these old growth trees are actually growing at incredible rates, adding unbelievable lumber, and that all that talk wasn't true. At least it's not true in the redwoods.
Yeah.
This is the main point that wasn't in the book, is that he's convinced, he's completely convinced that you can recreate old growth habitat for old growth dependent species like the spotted owl in second growth forests. He said, no doubt about it, it can be done in a couple of decades. In a few decades, you could do it. It doesn't take hundreds of years to redo it. So that's something that I don't know anything about. He's the expert, but I'd love to get him to be able to do that on our lands. And I know part of that is killing tops of trees and causing them to reiterate several tops and then doing it again. And you create all this complex structure up high in the canopy. But I don't know how to do it. I'm not sure he knows how to do it. I know what he wants to accomplish. I don't know if he knows how to do it. But I'd love to have him have our 500 acres as a laboratory to create habitat and bring, we got to do it. You know, you got to have the old growth dependent species in the forest because that's part of the balance that maintains the order in the woods. And there's so much about the restoration work itself, but there's no point in getting into that because you've got all that in the manual. But anyway. This whole thing about building a product line and being able to pay your way is the key because when we first started as a nonprofit, I could never do it. I mean, I asked people for money and stuff and we bought a bit of land, but I don't have the personality to be begging for the rest of my life to grow a timber company that's dependent on others' handout. What kind of a vision is that? What kind of an example is that? The example to create is, look, manage your land so that you can afford to do the best ecological work, which only benefits you and your children anyway. It's all tied together. You know, like right now, okay, we lost money for 10 years, a ton of money. But we've got 12 million board feet of lumber in our forest lands. And most of that is in good quality trees because of the way we've been managing our land. 12 million board feet. Now, yeah, we sell the average piece of furniture forever redwood is over $15 a board foot. So that means we've got $180 million worth of furniture lumber on our lands. $180 million. Most people look at 600 acres of land, they say, yeah, I'd be lucky if I can get a couple hundred grand out of a timber harvest after cane the logger. You know? That's why I know that we will obliterate everyone that doesn't practice some kind of vertical integration selling a high quality product line out of the wood. If they're just selling logs and selling boards, they're completely dependent on the commodity market pricing structure that they have no control over. So they're going to go through booms and busts, and as they bust, we'll pick them up. Done.
How much has the financial struggles impacted the amount of, like, you know, actual forestry work that you're able to do?
Very little, because I'm insane. And I just pushed everyone that was financially involved in the company to the brink of insanity and never cut back on the restoration work. I've agreed year after year to cut back on the restoration work with my partners, but I never do. I can't. That's the heart of the matter.
So what?
We thin.
So what? Give me a better idea. Like, what does a typical season look like? Like, what's going on right now there in the your forest land?
Last year we thinned. We thinned and planted about 60 acres out of our 600 acres. Last year we did about 60 acres. We're just finishing planting this week, and we're getting ready to get an non-industrial timber management plan in place for 325 acres, so that we have the lands that we need to harvest for the next 4 years. And the harvesting is basically, we used to do 10% cut and then let the land sit for 10 years and come back and do another 10% cut. But when Michael Fay from the National Geographic Society came out 2 years ago and spent 3 days with me, he said that he thought that I should do a 15% cut and then let the land sit for 15 years. He said it would be better for the land if I let it rest more in between intervals and cut a little bit more initially. And, you know, it took me a while to come around to agreeing with him and changing that point away from what Hans Burkhardt said. Because Hans was really adamant about cutting 10% per decade. But I think he's right. I think 15% every 15 years is actually a better way to go. It's going to be less cost, less disturbances to the soil, and less habitat, damage. So, you know, you can go see our lands a year after we've been there, and it looks great. You know, it looks messy when we're doing it, but that's just for a month or two. And then it looks great. So what do we do? I have two guys. All they do is limb and cut down lower quality trees year round. Well, not year round. They can't do it during the rainy season, but about 8 months out of the year. We've got two or three people that harvest the lumber. They drop the chosen trees every year and skid them out. They fix the roads. The two guys that are cutting the lower quality trees, we don't sell firewood anymore. So all that material is left in the woods to rot back into the soil. We cut everything down to below boot height so that it can get scattered throughout the forest floor to cover the forest floor and to create structure. And that's like the best fertilizer you can give the woods. There's small wood pieces and limbs and leaves and very small limbs. That's where most of the nutrients, most of the minerals are. So all that decomposes back into the soil, building up the soil productivity, protecting it from drying out. We limb up the lower limbs of the trees so that you have lower the fire hazard by eliminating fire ladders. You do actually increase the fire hazard the first year that you thin. That's known. But after a year, the material is decomposed enough where you've actually substantially lowered the fire hazard. There is that 1 year when you first have all that material on the ground that's decomposing where your fire risk is actually higher. So,
Have you ever had a fire on your land?
Yeah. we didn't. It didn't start on our ranch. It started on a vineyard adjacent to our ranch. But, yeah, we lost about 5 acres to fire. But, you know, fire is a deceiving thing. I mean, you think you've lost the land. You don't lose it. It just changes. Some of the trees, like redwood, sprouts back from fires. You can go through and you can have a 5-acre burn. The madrone, the dark fir, the sugar pine, the tan oaks are all dead, and they're not coming back. The redwood, not all of them, but most of the redwood trees will sprout new branches and come back to life, even if they look like a charcoal briquette. Because it's genetically a superior tree. It's very complex genes, and it's not called lives forever for nothing. Sempervirens. Sequoia sempervirens. We maintain our own nursery from seed stock that we get from different nurseries we grow. We get the small plugs that are maybe 4 or 6 inches tall, and then we grow them in our own 5-gallon buckets, 2 and 3-gallon buckets too, but a lot of 5-gallon buckets. We grow them in our own nursery for 2 or 3 years until the trees are 2 or 3 feet tall and they have really robust, thick root balls. And then we plant those deep in the soil, and we throw 4 to 6 inches of duff above after they're planted. And that's, you know, you've read the letters I've sent about that. You know, you look at that stuff.
Yeah, it's in the autoresponder.
It's in the
autoresponder. Tree planting 101.
Yeah, tree planting 101, exactly. So it's not rocket science, man. It's just about constancy. It's about not violating your principles. It's about constantly looking for ways to improve your practices. And, you know, we've been doing it for 15 years and, you know, look around now and I guess we're the experts because nobody's really doing it. And doing it to, you know, a lot of people have their own ideas. You know, I know people that like to use Garlon and different chemicals to kill the tan oaks so that the redwoods can grow. To me, that's just, you know, that's just heretical. You don't want to be using chemicals in the woods. You don't want to be using man-made fertilizers. You want to keep it all natural. You want to work with the natural processes of the earth. You don't want to be bringing science. It's not that kind of science, not chemical science into the woods. That just messes with the soil productivity. Then the soil becomes dependent on man-made inputs to maintain its productivity. At that point, you're fucked. Species composition of the forest has to be maintained. You can't just plant redwoods and try to get a pure redwood forest because same thing, you start mining the soil once you mess up the balance of the symbiotic relationships between all the different species. There's a reason there's 11 species or whatever it is in an apple, you know. There's a reason for it. And it varies from hillside to hillside and elevation and all that. And the aspect, if it's east-facing mountain or a west-facing mountain. But whatever was there, you've got to respect it. You've got to try to maintain a balance similar in species composition to what was already there so that the soil won't go into imbalance long-term. It's all about long-term viability. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
I think you've got enough, you know. You might want to look, when you have time, look at the stuff I said at the beginning about the 55% versus the 22% now. And look at what percentage of the remaining forests today are still primeval, they're still virgin. Very little. And then you can understand, you can cut through the bullshit, because forestry is full of BS, you know. The industry people will tell you, well, there's more acreage in forest land in the United States today than there was 100 years ago. And you'll say, well, then what's the problem? Well, yeah, it's true. There is more forest land today than there was 100 years ago. But there's a lot less standing timber volume today than there was 100 years ago. Because 100 years ago, there was a lot of virgin forests. Maybe there was 10 or 20% less acreage because there was more farms. So those farms have gone feral and have grown lumber again. But that lumber can't compare to what was there, what was cut in California and in Oregon and Washington State. which was all virgin 100 years ago, or just about all virgin, with enormous quantities of lumber. So it's the amount of standing timber that determines how much carbon is sequestered in the forest. It's the amount of standing timber that matters. You got to have a forest of trees of all ages, which includes old growth and very mature trees. You got to have it. That's the way it's supposed to be. And we're going to do it. We're going to do it. And I got to tell my partners, you know, in the 22nd century or in the 23rd century, school kids will study this little company called Forever Redwood that changed the way forestry practice on Earth. They'll study it. Hopefully they won't remember my name, but they'll remember the company that did it.